Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. The mayor's race in Boston could be telling us don't give up just yet on the American way of politics. Don't give up on the home of the bean and the cod either. 50 years ago, Boston sounded like this.
I can remember as a small child being shown Boston through the eyes of my grandfather, who was the first Irish Catholic mayor in the city at the close of the 19th century.
Irish city. Real Irish and good people. Sentimental Irish.
By 2021, the big old town of tribal neighborhoods might as well be on a different planet. The finalists for mayor are both women, family roots in Taiwan and Tunisia. The race is driven by a fresh wave of activists and organizers weaned on the pandemic, the climate crisis, and Black Lives Matter. Yet the air of Boston politics is all its own. Far from the national dystopia, utterly un-Trumpian in tone, democracy is still celebrated in Boston. Andrea Campbell strikes our keynote. In the preliminary for mayor, she ran a close third, so she missed the runoff. And nonetheless, she glows, recounting what she learned about the city and herself.
The city of Boston is the best city in the country because we have an ecosystem that no other place has right here. And our issues are solvable and manageable because we're a small size with that incredible ecosystem. I'm talking about the philanthropic foundations. I'm talking about the philanthropic community, the corporate community, the emergent industries, biotech, life sciences, our hospitals, our higher ed institutions, our civic leaders, our civic infrastructure. The list is long in terms of how rich our ecosystem is compared to other places. And the issues are solvable and manageable because our size is small. We're not New York City. So that's a positive, beautiful thing that we have yet to leverage to solve the issues that plague the city of Boston. And what are those? One metric that is always lifted up is the racial wealth gap. And I think it really speaks to the problems in Boston public schools, education, housing, lack of support, healthcare inequities, all of that. You need every piece of that in order to be successful. And so the racial wealth gap numbers really do, in many ways, capture what is wrong.
Tell us about the new era and your own era growing up.
I was reflecting on this just last night. I was reading something that I had written over 10 years ago. I just graduated from Princeton and was starting my career and commuting at times from New York to Boston and reflecting on why I love this city so much. And what I wrote was just that it had given me everything to be successful. It had given me great schools, mentors, after-school programming, a sense of community. And it gave me all of that, even though personally, my brothers and I were experiencing incredible instability with the loss of our biological mother, our father being incarcerated. And so I love this city because it's given me just that, everything. You know, I got involved in politics and ran for public office to be a public servant to not only highlight what this city has given me, but also to name the fact that it still has yet to deliver that opportunity to every resident equitably, especially to residents that live in certain neighborhoods, especially residents of color. And so I've always seen my work as a public servant as being about closing persistent gaps and opportunity in the city of Boston. And so, yes, we've come a long way, and as demonstrated by my story, as demonstrated by the fact that I could run for political office, run for mayor in the city of Boston, become the first Black woman to serve as city council president, also recognizing there's still significant work to do. My neighborhoods were largely South End and Roxbury. I grew up behind 1850 Washington. I used to go a lot to the Cooper Community Center, which is still there. There was a Catholic church behind where we lived near Rosie's Place that we would go to that was open for programming for young students that isn't there anymore. I also had a church community, Abundant Life Church, which has been around for over 100 years. And my father was born in Roxbury in 1933. And when I was born, he was 50 years old. So fast forward 50 years. He often talked about that history that we were reading about and how there was a robust, rich Black community in Roxbury in the South End. Even in moments where there were folks who were showing up in that community with not so necessarily good intentions. My father had a very long criminal background that I talk about freely. He did too. And he always stressed he wanted us to do different and do better. But what he also recognized, fast forward 50 years later, when we were growing up in the 80s and the 90s, is that the South End in Roxbury had changed dramatically and was continuing to change around us. So he saw the signs of gentrification, of displacement. We lived in affordable housing in a brownstone in the South End. He often would remark if he had the resources, he would buy that brownstone so we could stay in the community. He could never afford that because we were on public assistance growing up. So in many ways, this neighborhood that meant so much to him was sort of slipping between our sort of fingertips in ways I don't think I really would have recognized and felt had he not talked about the history of those communities. And so my reality was very different, I think, from other young people because of that history that I heard about frequently. Now I live in Mattapan, which we know is a very robust and rich Black community, a lot of elders of color, an immigrant community that we didn't see necessarily as richly in growing up in the South End, large Haitian population. So Boston's more diverse, it's more multilingual, things that we should absolutely celebrate and that I'm excited about because those pockets of community exist now too. The question is, how do we empower them in the city of Boston and how do we ensure they have access to opportunity?
Mattapan, Dorchester, houses being painted, prices going up. There's the catch. Not everybody will be able to afford it, but there's something very growthy happening.
I think that richness in community and growth and just amazing things have been happening for generations. It's the stories that go untold, though, especially by mainstream media. You hear about Dorchester and Mattapan from this negative deficit lens, poverty, inequity. Yes, that is real, and that needs to be acknowledged as facts that exist in these parts of the city compared to others. But there are people on the ground doing the work to change those outcomes. What they need are partners in government, a sense of urgency from institutions in Boston to show up and work in partnership with them, empower them to do the very work they've been doing for generations.
There's a new day coming in all of these neighborhoods. What are the essentials in housing, for example, or in schools?
There is a new era in many ways. One, just represented by the demographics in the city, by the robust immigrant communities that exist here, which should be celebrated, are beautiful. We often talk about the Asian community. I have a large Vietnamese population in my current district. The Latino and Latinx community expands almost every country you can think of. The Haitian community, the Cape Verdean community. The list is long in terms of who is here and what our institutions draw. The medical institutions, the higher ed institutions draw folks from every country probably in the world. But for me, the piece that needs immediate work is just an overall investment. Investment, namely, in communities that have been underinvested in for generations. And we know those communities because they're the communities, what we call the red flags, that have the transit deserts, the food deserts, public housing that hasn't been renovated in 30 years, that have economic business districts that are not robust, that have communities still living with the fact that their children don't have access to excellent schools right in their communities. And so the list is long. So for me, it's about investment in jobs, economic opportunity, in infrastructure, in schools, in
money,
housing.
Though. Are we talking feds, city, state, money, private?
Money is one piece, and that's at every level of government and from every ecosystem in the city of Boston. You think about folks who are leaving, say, Chinatown because of rising rents and cost of living going to Quincy. And why? There's a community in Quincy. There's an infrastructure in Quincy that community organizations have built. And you see the same in the Haitian community, going to Randolph or Brockton and establishing communities there because there's infrastructure built by those communities and those residents and those elders and those people. And so how do we get ahead of that to be more proactive so our folks don't have to leave? Because these are talented individuals in communities that bring such richness in diversity and in knowledge and expertise on a whole host of issues that could help us solve our problems a lot quicker if we were more inclusive and more inviting. Boston is indeed too expensive to live in. We see it every day, and it was the number one issue that came up along the campaign trail from every resident I spoke of, including those who were wealthy who found it really disturbing that Boston was not affordable. Residents want specifics. including from these two candidates, on how they will use that authority of the mayor's office with a sense of urgency and immediacy to ensure they can stay here, they can live here, they can move in from a rental opportunity to a homeownership opportunity. That means, of course, not forgetting folks who live in public housing and making sure they have opportunities, making sure people have access to mortgage tools that don't require down payment assistance. My push to both candidates is to be really specific, especially if they want to see more voters come out in November, because that's what voters want. They want to know and believe that government can help them.
To me, the most encouraging thing in this race has been the investment in the Boston Public Schools. Two finalists, both happy to say, to boast that their kids go to Boston Public Schools. 25 years ago, I ran for mayor. There were 9 candidates. I was the only one who had 3 kids, any kids, in Boston Public Schools. Something's fundamentally changed, and it's encouraging.
But at the same time, I want to be clear, there is significant work to do for Boston Public Schools. We just lost roughly 2,000 families. It's the sharpest decline we've seen in BPS in the last 15 years. Majority of black students are gone. They've left to MECO, charter schools, or they've moved out of the city of Boston because BPS has failed them. English learners are still struggling within Boston Public Schools to get what they need. When you think about early ed, we do not have universal pre-K. That is a shame in the city of Boston. Literacy rates for third graders, fourth graders, on our decline, and they have been for years. Infrastructure, high schools, that non-exam high schools, have been struggling because they are under-resourced. There is so many issues with Boston Public Schools. There are some things we can highlight as doing well, but the majority of issues, we're not doing well. If we're not honest about the scope of the problem, more families will leave. And that's a devastation, because if Boston Public Schools goes down in flames, we're all in trouble. And you can't tell me that BPS, which of course gave me 5 excellent BPS schools to attend, gave you great schools and so many others, that we can't get this right. We can. There's a lot to do, but families want to see specifics, and I do too.
Losers learn more in these races than the winners do, and you're going to win the next time. Andrea Campbell, it's a joy to meet you.
Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure. And now the question is, what comes next? And I'm excited about the possibilities.
That was City Councilor Andrea Campbell after a close call, third place in the mayor's race. Coming up, the education of a change agent. This is Open Source. We're sampling fresh air in Boston city politics. Carlton Williams calls himself a movement lawyer, meaning legal backup for what the late John Lewis called the good troublemakers. He teaches the practice at Cornell, and he works it at sites like the Standing Rock pipeline fight in North Dakota. In Boston, where he lives, he's astonished by the pace of change.
I think it's things happening in the world, it's things happening in the United States. I think there's a lot of sort of political machinery in Boston that said, this is the knighted one, this is the person who is allowed to run for this position, for a representative, for a state senator. The other underlying piece of this, we're now talking about the millennials, the Zoomers, and I just heard, they're not voting yet, but Gen Alpha, they're starting over in the alphabet, or starting over in the Greek alphabet, I suppose. So those two, and soon to be third generations, they're different than us, and they have ability to communicate, right? You have Twitter, you have Instagram, you have Snapchat, you have, you know, Zoom meetings, and you have an ability to do things and to communicate with audiences. And there are many, many bad things about that. There are also many, many good things about that. And we've seen the rise of a lot of people with a lot of really good ideas coming to the fore and supporting candidates, not supporting candidates, supporting ideas about policing, about criminal legal system, about, you know, what we do, about mass and caste.
The opioid corner.
Yeah, and in ways we would not have seen that before. I mean, some people have talked about, should people have clean injection sites? Should there be needle collection? Where I think 30 years ago, it would have been, how should we lock these people up and when should we lock them up?
We sense Boston on the verge of something. What kind of a turning point are we looking at?
We're likely to see a win for Michelle Wuitt, you know, very young mayor, progressive Asian American woman that has a lot of new ideas for the city, right? Previously, when the sort of machinery put folks in place, you sort of had to follow the rules more. Councilor Wu, possibly soon to be Mayor Wu, is going to have a little bit more of a mandate and a little bit more of a freer hand, feeling that she was really elected by the people, not sort of by some machinery.
Carl, I feel we're living in the year of the organizer. It's passed a test getting from advocacy to electoral politics. That's a big leap, and it doesn't always happen.
Certainly, this Overton window, like the window of what is acceptable to discuss, and that people will say, oh, that's an idea I've heard, we can talk about that. That window has been blown open in terms of public health, police accountability, the criminal legal system, race, gender, LGBTQ issues in unbelievable ways in the last 2 or 3 years, really probably since the Black Lives Matter movement and undocumented students rising up with the combination of social media. That's one thing, and victories have been made in themselves. Whether or not they are tested by this election is incredibly important, but it isn't the single litmus test. If we came in a time machine, right? I like time machines because they're useful. If we came in a time machine from the year 2000,
okay,
and we came to today, we didn't get to see any polls, and we said, these are the two candidates. First of all, we'd be like, those are the two candidates for mayor, and one of those people is seemingly certainly going to be mayor. How much would the 2000 version of you, and I used to listen in 2000, the 2000 version of you and the 2000 version of me, we would be like, it's not going to be that lady. It's not going to be the really young, really smart Harvard kid, not originally from Boston, who is Asian American. It's not going to be her.
Yeah, it's a different place.
The 2000 version of us would be like, holy smokes, these are the people who are running. And you're telling me, you future people are telling me that one of these people is going to win. But for, you know, most of the people in Boston, that's not so long ago, right? And I think that's an amazing stride that we've made in terms of where we are, even right now.
Boston used to be famous for contentious city politics. That spirit is somehow eclipsed, maybe forever.
Yeah, you know, and I know, Boston is a real small town, right? With a city attitude, maybe. Or it's a city attitude in a real small town. And that, combined with the newer generations and social media, make it harder to be that vicious, and gender. So I think it's the new generation, small town, big city, and that there are women running.
Carl, profile this generation if you can. You know them all. The activists, the confidence among them, the decision to go electoral politics.
They're not like, I want power. They're like, I want to make my community better. I want to work with people in my community and make my community better. What do I pick up? A shovel, a rake, a hoe, a city council seat, work at an organization, be a lawyer. I've seen them, you know, through their lives say, what is the best way I can affect this?
Let me be bold. As a Boston Irish guy from way back, I see Black and brown Americans discovering something. It's called city politics, and it's organizing. It's very Tip O'Neill. I mean, Ayanna won the way Tip O'Neill won that same seat half a century or more ago. I see people learning a new trick called organizational politics.
I really think that the 21st century has allowed people access to things that were, you know, hidden in a library, or they were in some, you know, Democratic wonk's back of their head, right?
Interesting.
Like the people who organized the George Floyd demonstration, a lot of those were like college students had just come back or had just graduated and had just come back to Boston. And they said, oh, this thing happened, we should organize a protest.
Right.
Very new to organizing. And they just put the word out in a really good way. And people were ready to listen for that. They're like, what are we doing in Boston? We want to be the hell out in the streets. I have friends that are like DJs and music producers, and these organizers put the perfect beat out there. They had the perfect break on it, and people are like, I want to dance to this. I'm 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. I'm going to set the world on fire. I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to do something. I'm going to change for my community, because people used to say like, oh, I wish I grew up in the 60s because I would have X, Y, and Z. And these kids literally were saying that. They were like, we don't have to have been in the 60s because it can be now for us.
A generation has been formed in the last 2 years, and we're going to see its effect.
You know, some of those people are like, oh, I want to start, you know, a socially responsible business. Other people are like, I'm going to do media work. And then other people I see drifting towards campaigns. The other thing is the demographic change, of course, has changed this, right? The fact that, you know, you can be in a community and say like, you know, if I got a lot of the Haitian vote, I could get elected. Or if I got a lot of the Caribbean vote, I could be elected. Or if I get a lot of the Dominican and Puerto Rican vote, I could be elected. None of that is certainly monolithic. But I think people feel that that's a possibility, certainly for, you know, district city councilors and state reps. I also think side hustle, gig economy allows people to say like, I can try to do my own thing, right? I can try to have a, you know, progressive t-shirt printing company.
Right.
The communication allows freedom in ways to do things that people wouldn't have been able to do before.
What's possible in the way of participatory budgeting in the city, for example. What's the agenda?
We can live in a city where the people who live, work, and go to school in the city decide where their resources go in a real way. I think we can live in a city where people who are sick, whether it's physical, mental, you know, addiction-based, can get sympathetic assistance with their illnesses, whether it's COVID or whether it's opioid addiction, right? Because we should look at those things in the same way, not like these people are less, these people are bad, and these people are criminals. We can live in a city like that. I want to live in a city like that. And I see a day that we do live in a city like that. But the when is when we fight like hell to create that city. And we are.
Carl Williams, thank you. Thank you for your work. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
In this Boston on the verge of something, Armani White, just turned 30, stands as a modern model of the homegrown change agent, bridge builder, self-effacing politico.
It is definitely a major change from what I remember. I think it's really amazing to see how far we've come and to see the things that the candidates are talking about. I think progressives and progressive issues are more common sense now, which I think is a testament to the work of the movement for justice.
What are the landmarks for you?
The killing of Trayvon Martin might have been one of the first big moments for me. As a young black person, I was like, okay, this is messed up. This young black man was attacked and murdered, and they're trying to make it seem like he was the person that did it. Right after that, probably the murder of Mike Brown. You know, between those two, that led to young people across the country advocating. I remember reading about folks in Florida taking over the state house in protest of the bill or the law that allowed Trayvon Martin to be killed, the Stand Your Ground law, and so looking at what they were doing and thinking about how do we bring that level of intensity and intention to the movement locally here in Boston.
The obvious landmark in Boston politics was Ayanna Pressley going to the Boston City Council to Congress, what was Tip O'Neill's old House seat, JFK's before that. That marked a possibility that people didn't know was there before. And it was all basically knock on every door twice kind of organizing.
You're right. Yeah, no, that's the type of, that's that I think the kind of organizing that it takes to get communities of color to come out and to come out in large numbers and also that to build large coalitions, multiracial coalitions. Yeah, that's the winning special sauce.
Speak of the coalitions you see forming, Armani.
Well, the one that I see is with the Right to the City Vote, which I'm the chair of. We have a coalition of folks, you know, Chinese folks, working class Chinese folks from Chinatown and all over the city, Latinx folks from all over the city. Working class Asian folks, I should say, from all over the city, not just Chinese, because we have folks like from Dorchester that are Vietnamese. We have, historical African-American community as well as the Caribbean community represented in our coalition. And we try to work closely with white progressive working class aligned organizations to come together and really build our power, our electoral and political power to elect candidates that will speak to and act upon our platform.
What's the agenda, Armani, in housing, in opioids, in policing?
We have a number of things that we focus on: the right to stable housing and equitable development, the right to economic justice and good jobs, the right to participatory democracy, and the right to public good and racial justice, and the right to a healthy environment. Within those tenets are essentially our response to your question. You know, when we look at the situation at Mass and Cass, we are pushing for like a public health approach. We're pushing for...
We're talking about the epicenter of the opioid crisis, right?
Yeah, right. We're looking at that with a racial justice lens, with the public health lens, and with the lens that, you know, this is a statewide problem that has landed in the seat of a diverse but majority community of color. And we focus on a number of different issues, though, right? Not just that one particular issue. We're also leading the fight to essentially help solve the crisis right now with housing, where people have lost jobs due to COVID. People were already out of work before COVID. Rents were already high. Rents are still increasing. People are still out of work. And so fighting to keep eviction moratorium, fighting to at the state level for more funding for folks who are in need, fighting for good wages and against wage theft. We do pretty much it all.
Armani White, speak of the spirit of this moment. strikes me as rather amazingly constructive. It's hard fought, but it's not bitter. It's not name-calling divisive. It doesn't pose one part of the city against another.
You know, it's funny you say that. I felt like this election has started to get into that through some of the comments about, like, oh, where are people from? And at the same time, I like that the focus has stayed on policy and solutions. That's at the mayoral level. I think in some of the district races, we've seen things get pretty ugly.
Does it help that there are no white men in it? It dissolves the old race line that we're so tired of.
Yeah, you're right. I think it is good to have no men in the final. I think it is great, actually. And I love it. It is great to see diversity and to not just have a white man again in the final. I think what makes it interesting is that we have a woman of color, Arab identifying, and an Asian woman. When we tend to think of race in America, it's black and white. I still think that there are racial voting blocks. There's white voters and there's black voters. You know what I mean? I think that Boston, the candidates are new and different, and the voters are somewhat new and different, but we still, you know, it's not like there's completely different new Boston.
Armani White, tell your own story in the essentials, especially how you got from a race consciousness at Trayvon Martin time to electoral politics. Where are you coming from?
So I was raised right. I feel like I was raised in a household that told me to give back to my community and to never, like, quote unquote, leave them behind, no matter how successful I may be. And grew up in a household where politics was talked about. No one in my family was an elected official. My family are not politicians. But yeah, caring about politics, getting involved in local meetings. My grandmother and mother were on project review committees for local developments. When I was a kid, hearing them talk about Northeastern encroaching on community land. My grandmother ran somewhat of a cooperative child care center in Bromley Heath Projects for over 50 years.
It's public housing in Boston.
Right. I grew up in the Bromley Heath Housing Projects, Nabmadge Haley. My grandmother, yeah, was a woman who helped raise a whole generation of young people. So I come from a family of public service. Both my parents have done public service work. So getting into advocacy, they have no idea how I ended up in this, but I think it makes sense based off of what I just explained. But the consciousness part was deciding, going into full time, that's what I was going to do for work, was working at a homeless healthcare center, Boston Healthcare for the Homeless, and learning about the homelessness crisis, and seeing in my community folks that were homeless, having dealt with housing insecurity myself through the 08 foreclosure crisis, getting evicted, really realized that as a society that we had a lot of work to do to solve the issues of making sure everyone had a roof over their head, food in their belly. And yeah, I felt like policy was the way to change that. And so really just committed myself. That was probably when I was 17, 18, committed myself to like political advocacy work. And that was before there was a movement for Black lives in America. And yeah, kind of see myself as a part of helping like push that movement that we now see ourselves a part of. And that has been kind of my, just keeping that ball rolling. But I think it starts from, like, you know, my family, but then a personal interest on my own, and then following through with it. I'm a pretty determined person. If I want to do something, I try to make it happen. I think the my progression as an advocate, as an organizer, is one that a lot of folks have. You know, I come into the work very upset and full of piss and vinegar, as you should, and wanting things to change very quickly, and then you learn that things take time that we live in a representative government where laws take time to pass and you must elect representatives to pass those laws that you want passed. And that it takes a lot of work to get people elected. And to get people elected, you have to actually educate voters to elect people who will meet their needs. So very quickly learned that the work of changing the way society works isn't easy. It takes both outside yelling and takes having a critical mass of the right people on the inside to actually move the needle. This has been the history and the like legacy of like the African American freedom struggle in America that I see myself a part of, organizing internally and externally. I don't think there's ever been a time where that wasn't the case.
Is there a new understanding of Boston itself, its variety, its pain, its possibility, that we hadn't known before.
If you're a person of color, black, Latino person, Asian person in the city of Boston, you've known the city to be one of great opportunity, probably, but also of a lack of access, of inequity. And so as we see our numbers, black and brown numbers rise, we now have the numbers that it takes to elect people that represent us.
What are we building here?
We're building a movement for justice, for a true restructuring of the way that things are done so that folks who have been left out are now included. It's about, about making sure everyone's voice is at the table and has a chance at a slice of the pie. It's led by multi-generational folks. It's multiracial, intergenerational, and powerful, and growing. So I think that's what we're working towards. So we're just, I think the goal is to have a city that, or a true city on the hill. I think there's a lot of work to do to right the harms of slavery, of colonization, but that's part of working towards that.
You've worked hard for this cause, and it's beginning to show.
I have to pinch myself sometimes, because 10 years ago, when we were upset about Trayvon Martin's murder, I couldn't have imagined that there would be this movement for Black Lives, movement for justice in the country that we see today. And although we do see the fascist, right-wing Trump movement growing, I think we see the movement for justice and for people also growing.
Armani White, thank you for your story. You'll be the boss of the town before we know it. Thank you.
Happy to come talk about elections, and I hope everyone listening goes out and votes November 2nd.
Coming up, a Boston compulsion to run for something. This is Open Source. Kendra Hicks, born in the Bronx, is an activist of standing in Boston and a first-time candidate for office this year. She's running for the Boston City Council from the family neighborhoods of West Roxbury and Jamaica Plain. I asked her what got her off the sidelines and onto the ballot.
I wouldn't call where I was the sidelines. I think that I have been very civically involved and engaged in my community since a very young age. I started doing community organizing work when I was 15, whether it be as a youth organizer fighting for an increase in the youth jobs budget in the city, whether it be doing violence prevention and intervention work, then as a youth worker later on, doing public health, racial equity work across the city. But what got me from doing that direct on the ground work to wanting to go into electoral politics, it's because I've realized, and I think a lot of us have realized, that electoral politics is a really important lever to be able to pull, particularly local politics specifically, that if we're able to pull that lever in an effective way, we can have a really big impact on the material conditions of the people in our communities.
The old-fashioned questions: schools, church, neighborhood, jobs.
So I graduated from English High School here in JP. I am also a Curly School graduate. We have a big, big community of Curly parents here in the neighborhood. From English High School, I went to St. John's University in Queens, New York. And then from St. John's University, I attended a small leftist school in Plainfield, Vermont called Goddard College. And I'm currently still a student, actually. I haven't graduated yet.
You're known as an outspoken socialist with a lot of class consciousness, too. Factor that in.
I'm running my race as a Democrat, right? I think that right now what we have in this country is the Democratic and the Republican Party as the most effective. And so I've always been registered as a Democrat. I've always been a Democrat. But I've definitely always understood that the Democratic Party, with all of its challenges, really needed to have a voting bloc that was farther to the left, that was more progressive. And so I see democratic socialism as kind of being the birth of that, as kind of like building a new voting bloc within the Democratic Party that's much more progressive, much more leftist, and focused on making sure that government works for the people and not just for corporations or developers or folks who have money.
Sounds like Bernie Sanders.
Absolutely. Bernie Sanders is one of my heroes. And I think that what he's been able to do is really change the discourse in the country around what we consider to be democratic socialism, what we consider to be possible, and how our government can actually take care of its people and make sure that poor and working class people are really front and center when it comes to the issues.
What made you think, Kendra Hicks, that Boston was ready for such a such a program?
Well, I have been living here most of my life. My family moved here from the Bronx when I was about 9 months old. And so I'm a Bostonian. And so I have seen the political shift in the city.
Describe it.
Yeah. So for me, when I was a youth organizer, we had the three progressives at the city council. Those were the people that Black and brown people, poor and working class people in the city knew would have their back and would vote in a way that was going to be beneficial to their community. Since then, we have had lots of people who have represented our communities, who come from our communities, who have been generally progressive, but not anybody who comes from social movements or who has been really, really involved and responsive to the needs and the demands of the people who are organizing on the ground. And so, you know, we often categorize this as like a move to the left. And actually, I think it's a move down deeper into the roots of our challenges and of our communities.
When do you feel that you're scoring, that you've made the right bet? When are the moments and the places where you feel, yeah, people were ready for something different?
You know, the two big neighborhoods in the district are Jamaica Plain and West Roxbury.
I know them both, yeah.
Yeah, they have very different demographics. And in each neighborhood, there's a mix of people who are either conservative or more left-leaning. And to me, when I know that people are ready for what we're doing, is when I can get on the phone with a police officer who's been a police officer for 36 years, and he says to me, I understand that we need to stop the pipeline to prison. We're not really doing anything. We're just sending people to jail. When I'm having those kind of conversations in West Roxbury, when I'm coming to JP and people are saying, hey, all of the things that you talk about, all of the experiences that you've had, that is something that me and my family have experienced. And we've never had anybody championing us, right? When people say, oh, finally, we're going to have someone who's representing these politics in City Hall, and we're really excited to get behind you. And honestly, at the preliminary election, when we came in first place by over 1,200 votes, it became very, very obvious that what we were bringing into this race is something that the people of this district want.
The Globe seems interested in your rent-paying record. Does it matter? Is it an issue?
I think it's absolutely an issue. I think that 338,000 people in the city live rent burdened, which means that they're paying more than one third of their income on their rent. And in a city where gentrification is running rampant and Black and brown people are being displaced left and right, it absolutely matters that I am very close to that issue. I think that being close to that issue actually uniquely positions me to represent the people of the city who are struggling to pay their rent and who are struggling with displacement. So yes, I think it actually matters. I think it shows how qualified I am to lead.
What do people ask and what do they say about your own history?
People can relate. They can relate to struggling to pay their rent. They can relate to, you know, going through eviction proceedings. They can relate to the stress that that causes in their life. They can relate to living under the thumb of a corporate landlord who will send a notice to quit if you're 5 days late on your rent, and so on and so forth. And so most people understand. And for those people that have questions that I share with them, kind of like, you know, what my situation has been, after they talk to me for a couple of minutes, it's pretty clear to them that this is an asset.
The underlying issue, if there is one, Kendra, in this race is that so many people in Boston can't afford to live here. What's the remedy?
The remedy is more affordable housing. So there's structural changes that we need to make, both with our zoning and in the way that we're building in our development, to make sure that we have more affordable housing in the city. Secondarily, I think that we need to make sure that affordable housing is accessible to people. We need to make sure that the affordable housing that we're building is actually going to people who can afford it.
Kendra Hicks, the sense of a new, different Boston, different from its past, different from the rest of the country, is palpable before this race is over. Imagine the city we will be living in if things go your way.
If things go our way, I think that we'll be living in a city where all of our communities can thrive. We'll be living in a city where our neighbors don't have to live with the fear of displacement. We'll be living in a city with fare free public transit. We'll be living in a city that is resilient in the face of climate change and protecting the communities that are going to be the hardest hit. We'll be living in a city that has significantly less violence. Our neighborhoods will feel safe. Our community will feel connected to each other. Our schools will be just and joyful and not solely focused on standardized testing, but actually preparing our young people to go out into the world and represent the city of Boston in the way that we know they can.
Kendra Hicks, it's a pleasure to hear a real candidate. Thank you for this conversation and good luck on voting day.
Thank you so much for having me, and hopefully this won't be the last time that we'll talk.
Sheena Collier is a professional networker in Boston. She's adopted the phrase Boston while black to map strategic links among the old inhabitants and newcomers like herself. She arrived from Atlanta in the 90s for graduate studies at Harvard's School of Education. What she discovered over the years was an unspoken rule that may be peculiar to Boston. It says that civic engagement is not an option, it's a requirement, maybe now more than ever.
You know, I've always experienced it as a place where you have to, even people that say like, oh, I'm not into politics, like, I feel like you can't live in Boston and not be. Right. It just requires you to be a civically engaged citizen in one way or the other, even if it's simply like you call 311 for issues. It just feels like that's part of being a Bostonian.
It's like high school football in Texas. You have to do it.
Right. Like, it just feels like that's part of being a Bostonian is being civically engaged. And even when thinking about celebrities in Boston, right? Like, well-known people, I've thought, you know, I've done events for years in Boston, so I'm always trying to think of like, oh, who would people want to see? And it's usually like elected officials. Like, those are like our celebrities that people really want to be like, oh, I met, you know, Ayanna Presley. I think it's just probably ingrained in who Boston is. You know, I worked at Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative for many years, DSNI. Like, as an employee there, you know, we were really accountable to the residents of the neighborhood. And they were able to, you know, they voted on our budget. You know, if they asked us to get involved with issues and the, you know, things around development, we had to as an organization. And I think it was just like an amazing opportunity. Like, people came out of that organization and are now civic leaders in the city. And so I think it's an example of how Boston, through neighborhood level engagement, one, gets people that really care, you know, young people who are picking up trash in your neighborhood, to then, you know, later on can become civic leaders. There's just like this ingrained pipeline in Boston in many ways that I think is unique to the city.
So the sense in Boston this fall is that everybody is running for something. Sidney Baptista is just running, period, for sport. And in the spirit of the season in Boston, he's built a vision into running and a campaign around it. The Pioneers Run Club is Sid Baptista's invention for personal and neighborhood health. This month, the club drew hundreds of amateur and first-time marathoners into a 26-mile run, not a race, through the streets of the city neighborhoods.
We created a running team to bring diversity into running and to also just activate our spaces. The neighborhoods I grew up in, people don't necessarily run, or it's not necessarily a thing to do. We decided to create a marathon that ran through the neighborhoods of Boston, a course that represents what we see as Boston. Most running communities, it's about the running, it's about how fast you are, it's about your time. Yep. And that inherently excludes a ton of people who aren't the fastest runners, who don't have a ton of time to train to be faster, versus people who are just needing it for their mental health, physical health, just to have options to move their body, and then also be in community with other people that look like them. And also be welcomed when you don't necessarily look like a traditional runner. So those are the people that we target. And we just focus on creating a community that is inclusive and creates an acceptance kind of feel.
Sid Baptista, your piece of a big picture, as I see it, Dorchester, Mattapan, lots of part of this city look better than they did 10 years ago, 20, 30 years ago. And I'm wondering what it is.
So I'd say, you know, one breath, yes, it seems to be more diverse and people are out more confidently speaking about their experiences. But unfortunately, we're getting pushed out of the city. Like, how much longer are we going to be able to afford living here? I mean, if you look at the numbers, people of color, black people specifically, don't make nearly as much money as their white counterparts. And so we're being priced out left and right. So although it might be feeling like a vibrant city, how much longer is it going to last if people can't pay to live here or can't afford to live here?
The issue underlying everything here is this kind of embarrassment of wealth. What's to be done about that? Driving out the people who have paid their dues to be here.
I mean, I think we can look to San Francisco, Brooklyn, as areas that of what potentially could happen here.
What I call the richification of New York, for example.
Yeah, it's tough. Even me, right? I grew up in the city. born and raised, and we thankfully have a family home that we own from the 90s that we live in. Outside of that, I don't know how, you know, because it's me, my wife, and my baby, my brother, his wife, and his baby. We have three other siblings that need to go through this house. So, like, how much longer can I even afford to live here? But part of also keeping and owning and wanting to own our stories and own our areas is also activating our spaces in ways that we need to. And so in creating the running team, we kind of own the narrative, and we also get to create the structure as to how we're growing. And so when people come into the neighborhood, they're finding it, and then we're showing them how to engage with the people who've lived there. The kind of structure that we've created is allowing people to engage with diverse communities, because that's something in Boston that's not an option because of the segregation of communities and where people live. So people aren't going to work together. They're not meeting in restaurants together. They're not being in the same health gyms together,
right,
in terms of, you know, people of different backgrounds and ethnicities.
They used to organize around churches. We're in the back lot of St. Ambrose in Dorchester. It barely exists as a church anymore. But you're organizing around a sport, around a self-image of athletics. How does it compare?
It's a great comparison, actually. You know, as much as we go into digital media and online presence, I think we all need community at the end of the day. We all need something that inspires us. And as human beings, we need to be in community with each other. And so creating a space where people can come together in an authentic way and be themselves, and then also be accepted as who they are, and also learn of different cultures, I think is special. And we do it naturally because our leadership is very diverse.
What do young people want in your neighborhood, Sid? What do they need? What are they missing?
From a younger age perspective, we need opportunities, structure, they need summer programming, they need jobs. We need to divert people away from even just being in the house on their phones and on social media and then doing something in community with each other. If you consider myself young, then we need to continue to come together as different citizens of the city to understand each other. And I have a saying that we live by. It's the more we run side by side, the more we see eye to eye. It's just something that I really believe in. So I grew up in Dorchester, but I had the, you know, I was one of the lucky kids who got sent away to boarding school to play sports. And so at a very young age, I was taken away from a majority black and brown neighborhood and put into a majority predominantly white experience. I think from that point on, I've been very much living two different kind of worlds. And what we've created at Pioneers Run Crew is a mix of just learning how to balance between the two worlds and knowing what people want and need and how people can see eye to eye.
People want to know how these bridges are built, maintained, enjoyed, reveled in. I mean, we're all dying for it in a way.
Yeah, it starts with compassion and willingness to understand and willingness to see others' experiences. But you don't do that unless you're spending time with people that are different from you. And so with a sport like running, where any given day you can be faster or slower than the person next to you, and you could be making connections with people who have joined maybe for the first week or that aren't having the best day or that are having an amazing day and they can bring you up. And some days you're the faster runner and that's motivating the person behind you, or in some days you're the slower runner that someone else is motivating in front of you. And so just being able to sweat together offline in community with each other, you know, does a lot for the mind, body, and soul.
Give me a snapshot of your Boston that's taking shape in 2021. One place, one focus, what would it be? Maybe it's a picture of runners.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll give you, today's Wednesday. We meet every Wednesday, 6:30 p.m. at Cesadia's in Bolden Street. So come out. We'll meet, play some music, greet each other, have people come together. We give announcements and celebrate one another for accomplishments. And we welcome people who come new. We warm up, very vibrant, laughing. And then we take off in 1 mile, 3 mile, and 5 mile groups. We run the streets of Bolden, Geneva. And so it's cars honking, it's music blasting, it's people on the stoops asking us why we're running, where we're running. It's people chasing after us, running with us a block. It's people who have come to join the community who've never been to this part of Boston, and they come back and they say, wow, people were talking to me and asking me and celebrating me. And so it's this inclusive space where people are welcomed and celebrated, and not just for being fast, but just for showing up for yourself and for your health.
One, two, three.
We honk for Sid Baptista and his runners, talking and running at the same time in neighborhood Boston, starting near Bowdoin and Geneva Avenues in Dorchester. Thank you, Sid. And thanks to Andrea Campbell, Carl Williams, Armani White, Kendra Hicks, and Sheena Collier. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from the WBUR production team. Mary McGrath is our long-distance runner. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source. Open Source is proud to be part of Hub and Spoke, a nonprofit collective of smart, independent podcasts. This week, check out The Ministry of Ideas. Host Zachary Davis talks with UC Riverside philosopher Maisha Cherry about our fraught relationship with anger. Listen in at ministryofideas.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and check out the whole Hub and Spoke lineup at hubspokeaudio.org.